between the wisdom passed down by ancient healing traditions, anecdotal experience, and modern clinical trials, one thing is clear: mushrooms are medicinal powerhouses. And I finally found a brand, a product, a company that I feel really aligns with all of my research and understanding when it comes to the medicinal properties of mushrooms, and that is Alchemy Mushrooms. They grow their mushrooms in California on organic mushroom farms. They keep the whole mushroom in their supplements, and they actually blend mycelium and fruit body in their mushroom powders and capsules to give you the best of both worlds. You can learn more at Alchemy Mushrooms. That's A-L-C-H-E-M-I. AlchemyMushrooms.com. Use the discount code MushroomHour for 20% off your order. Alchemy with an I, Mushrooms.com. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we have the privilege of interviewing Professor Vera Meyer from the Technical University of Berlin. Professor Meyer's career has seen her as a visiting scientist to the Imperial College of Science, Technology, and Medicine in London, and to the Department of Fungal Genetics and Metabolomics at Leiden University in the Netherlands. In 2008, Professor Meyer was appointed Assistant Professor for Molecular Microbiology and Biotechnology at Leiden University, a position she held for 3 years. Since 2011, she has been the professor at the Institute for Biotechnology and head of its Department for Applied and Molecular Microbiology at the Technical University of Berlin. Her scientific work in the field of fungal biotechnology has been published in more than 100 publications. Vera also works as a visual artist using the pseudonym V.Mir. She puts a strong emphasis on sculpting and creating objects from chance finds like forest mushrooms, decaying wood, and scrap metal. Inspired by her scientific work with fungi in microbiology, she combines these materials in the sense of a found object. Through her artwork, she wants to enhance the awareness for fungi and their potential in biotechnology and for a sustainable bioeconomy in general. And Vera, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really an honor, and it's going to be a treat to talk about so many different topics with you. But first, I always like to start with all of my guests with kind of an origin story. And I think yours, there's an interesting history of kind of bouncing around. So tell us a little bit about that background. And you can start as far back as you want, but especially some of that career arc that brought you to where you are today.
Okay, so actually already when I was a kid, I realized that things which I'm interested in are not the things that I can see. I was always interested in the invisible. So be it the microcosm, or be it actually most fascinating was to me the macrocosm. So I also always wanted to study astrophysics, and I was pretty sure that I'm going to fly to the moon. So this was, as a kid, it was clear to me this is the macrocosm. But then at a certain moment, I realized, okay, it's a bit too far to go, and perhaps at first I need to study something. And then I decided to study biotechnology with a specific focus on microbiology. So understanding the microorganisms, and it was in the 90s, basically this was also the time when we had another viral, basically, attack in the world, and this was AIDS, right? And one reason for me to study also biotechnology and microbiology was basically to contribute to new drugs against HIV. Kind of not accident, but it was a teacher of mine, and she teaches genetics, and I asked her, can I do an internship in your lab? And she said, yeah, why not? And she was working with fungi. And she was working on Aspergillus, strain Aspergillus giganteus, and that produced a so-called antifungal protein. And she knew that the protein was secreted into the medium, but she didn't know the gene of this protein. And she was interested in applying the protein, because this protein was specifically inhibiting the growth of fungi, so not of bacteria or yeast. And she and others could already show, okay, that also plant and humans are not affected. So we thought we have a new cool drug to fight fungi, right? And this is how I came into the field of, into the kingdom of fungi. And then she didn't need to persuade me to do a PhD. It was just for learning. This was something, or university, or working in a university setting, for me was always very much fascinating, the idea. So I can just learn and learn every day, day and night. So and I started my PhD in this group, and the supervisor, so the chair of the boss of the chair, that's for the, of the department, yeah, chair of the department, he actually gave as much as possible freedom. So I was the only person who was studying then filamentous fungi, so this Aspergillus protein. My former supervisor, she left. And he had a kind of a philosophy, I promote through demand. Yeah, so do whatever you want to do, but the more and the faster you do, you have to reach your goals. And then your goals, you can do whatever you want, but you have to reach your goals. And having this kind of freedom was excellent, but I never became connected to other groups because he was more yeast person. And this was then a reason why I decided I need to go to other groups after I got my PhD, and it was in the Netherlands, to become more connected to the fungal community. The supervisor there, Kees van den Handel, he's one of the pioneers in fungal biotech. He taught me really a lot. So he was really a role model for myself. It was just also do what you're interested in, and don't think that you need to do what others are expecting from you. Just do what you're interested in. And if you like this, what you're doing, then you will be good. Yeah, he connected me to other groups, to companies, and this is basically where I also started to understand, well, of course, there are situations where you need to fight fungi, but you can also use fungi because you can produce useful products with them, citric acids, proteins, enzymes, and so on. And I'm just telling this because both, so Ulf Stahl, my first supervisor, my PhD father, let's say, and Kees van den Handel, I worked with him when I was assistant professor, both basically told me, from both I learned, see fungi as friends and as foes. And whatever you want to do with them, either you want to fight them or use them, you need to understand the biology. You need to understand the genetics, and meaning you need to understand how they grow. Because the morphology, the hypha growth, that their survival mechanisms, this forms the basis for everything. You want to exploit them in biotech. So in 2011, I started my own group then in Berlin. And now we are a team of 50 people, and luckily just 20 or so are students, so undergraduate students who do their bachelor or master thesis. And the others just work on their PhD thesis or postdocs or are technicians. And again, so basically having this holistic view on the fungal kingdom. Try to understand their biology, try to understand their genetics. And from this, you can approach them with both sides of the coin, fight and use them. What I also realized during this time, so I started early 90s to study the tech development till today. So I wrote my bachelor thesis with a typewriter.
With a typewriter?
With a typewriter.
The frontiers thesis, of technology, yeah, with a typewriter.
Yeah. My master thesis, just I saved on a floppy disk. My PhD thesis on a CD, on a copy disk. And this was at the turn of the millennium, so the PhD thesis. And now we save everything on USB sticks that have terabytes of memory. This was one thing. And the other thing, what I noticed during these 30 years, and this explains a lot what we can do nowadays or what we were not able to do 20 or 30 years ago. So during my master project, I was not able to identify this AFP gene, this antifungal protein gene. It was this, we didn't have the technique yet. During my PhD, it took me half a year to get 1 kb of genome sequence from this protein and sequence it myself using radio-labeled Sanger sequencing. It sounds like this is middle age, right? And nowadays, right, for this 1 kb, you just send it today to a company, and today, and one day after, you get the sequence data back. So let's say the history my history is sort of, I think, became also exponential in terms of how much knowledge was accumulated, or we have accumulated, or we have to digest ourselves during the last years. So it's really, really amazing. And therefore, when you ask what I am, I consider myself, my career, I'm a professional student, I would say.
There is infinite amounts to learn. And I love how you just told that story of your career arc and how the technology overlays on that. Because we all know, I mean, mycology, but really microbiology, we're talking about the last couple decades. Yeah, exponential and then some in terms of how much we know. And of course, knowledge is that kind of cumulative practice. So just as researchers like yourself have been working, there have been breakthroughs, there's more and more that you can work with in your own research. So that's really interesting to see that occur. And, you know, something else you highlighted was that interdisciplinary approach in researching really anything with microbiology. And that shows up a lot in your writings and in your papers. You know, we've talked about that from the idea of biology, but for you, how important has it been to both expand your own scientific knowledge to different fields as you just research the things that you're passionate about? And what's it been like to collaborate with scientists from different fields? Maybe how has that transformed or aided your own research?
Yeah, starting with my studies. So when I studied biotechnology, I always felt a little bit uncertain because I got some idea about genetics, a little bit about biochemistry, a little bit about bioprocess engineering, a little bit about mathematics and physics. I had the feeling, okay, yeah, I know only a bit, but nothing real. But then later on, it turned out, and this is what I also say to my students nowadays, this is the best you could do, become a generalist. And then you can basically work with people from other disciplines because you understand their philosophy, you understand their way of working, their approaches. And I specialized in fungal genetics and genomics, but I can communicate with a bioprocess engineer, or I can communicate with a pure chemist. Although, of course, I have to say others who really feel, okay, it's just chemistry, yeah, then I say, okay, just become a specialist, become specialized. And this is also this what we see in nature. So you have in microbiology or biology in general, you have a generalist or you have specialists, and both have their pros and cons. I'm saying this because basically in my DNA and in my professional DNA is this interdisciplinary gene already present because of my study.
Right.
And I always like to what I also learned from Kees van den Hondel from the Netherlands, the supervisor I had there, the more open you are, the more collaborative that you are, the faster you will find the answers to your questions. This is also an attitude which is, at least when I started to study, was I wouldn't consider a German attitude. The other way around. So in Germany, we really had this often this elbow phenomenon. So people wanted to become respected as this is the expert on, and this is
right.
This and this changed during the last years. But in my opinion, this is also something which is in this Dutch culture somehow. This collaborative gene. And nowadays we collaborate with people from very different disciplines, be it in material science or architecture, or when talking about biomaterials or X-ray crystallography, when talking about understanding the 3D structure of proteins. But we also collaborate with artists or citizen scientists because my interest in art, my personal interest in art, I'm convinced that I, as a scientist whose salary is paid by tax money, that I'm responsible, and also my team, our science we are doing, our teaching we are doing is just paid by tax money. That is in our responsibility to explain to the society what we are doing, how we are doing it, and why we are doing this. And this is, of course, this should not be a one way. I'm not the sender and the others are receivers. This is not the way how it should go. It is a mutual exchange. And therefore, I'm very much convinced that science has to open its labs. It just has, on the one hand, to go outside, but also to bring the outside inside. And this is, for example, through citizen science projects. I can mention that this the fungi project we were running 2 years ago, but there are also other projects we are running now. Now I have artists in residence. I have citizen scientists in residence, basically. And this is really fun. Not only because we get the thoughts and ideas and visions of the others. It's just because as a professional, and I like this role, I'm not the strict leader anymore. Of course, I have to lead. But right. I don't have to give the, I'm not the only one who give the ideas which way we have to go in research or what kind of experiment or it's just, it became much more open. I'm not the, yeah, it's a cooperative way of working. It became a cooperative way of working.
I mean, just so many huge insights. I think one of my new favorite sayings that I'm going to start living by is this idea of the more open you are, the more collaborative you are, the faster you get to your answers. I love that. Yeah. And I think, you know, highlighting as well that idea that there are generalists, there are specialists, who knows how much of that is shaped by inherent makeup of the person versus life experience. Who knows? Maybe it's because of the organisms or the things you choose to study. You know, Vera has spent so much time studying these microorganisms that have these collaborative, so suddenly she's becoming more collaborative. You know, who knows how much that plays into it? But it also shows up, yes, in these other fields because you yourself are an artist and you're kind of not just interdisciplinary within science, but also kind of interdisciplinary within all these other disciplines of human culture, human experience, which I think is so fascinating. And really, I think for a lot of us is what appeals to an amateur like myself, is what appeals about mycology. And I think you could broaden that to microbiology in general. It seems to have a more open atmosphere that is a participatory environment where, yes, the scientists are doing the research, bringing down these amazing insights from that research, but it seems to have a more collaborative air about it where citizen scientists can collaborate and get involved. And I think, yeah, I think you just highlighted that beautifully.
Yeah. And basically it is also in a strict sense, also about diversity, right? So if you expect, or if you recognize diversity as a momentum of wealth of thoughts and ideas and capabilities. So the only thing basically you have to assure with the people you want to work with is that you share the same passion, right? You want to reach something. Yeah, you want to change the world, or you want to contribute to bioeconomy or to circular economy or whatever. You want to find a new drug, and you want to find new biomaterials. So if you share the passion, that is the only thing you have to secure. And the rest is basically the more diverse the people are, the more different expertise that they can bring in. And I consider research, artistic research, as similar as scientific research or as citizen scientist research. It is all try and error method. This is all, we all want to try to understand the world, and we want to be part also, to be part of the world. And diversity brings us together, definitely.
Another amazing insight, diversity is wealth. I mean, diversity of ideas, opinions, perspectives is incredible amount of wealth. And talk about too then your kind of idea of making, or talk about making science open access, because that goes along with all of this. And I know having many guests on who are professors and researchers, you know, you can find some of their work through Google Scholar or on ResearchGate, you can start finding things, but not everything is out in the public sphere. For you, who's kind of embracing this collaborative science, kind of blending with everything, how important is it for you for science to be open access, and how does that happen?
1000% important. So since more than 10 years or so, I'm publishing open access only. Actually, I have declined all my, so I have been in editorial boards of non-open access journals. I have basically stepped down from this task. I only publish in open access journals, and whenever I get a request, Vera, why do we want, we want you to write a review in blah, blah, blah. And then I check, is this open access, the journal? And if not, then I said, I'm sorry. I'm not going to write for you. Yes, I'm very strict about this. And of course, therefore, our work never appears in specific journals, but I don't mind.
Right.
They then appear in others.
Well, so this is a radical approach to me. You know, is this something that you find shared by a lot of your scientific colleagues? Is it something that's more in terms of what scientific discipline you study is different? Like I said, with people that study organisms that tend to blend boundaries, is that you're more willing to blend, to be collaborative? What is this thread of open access, ultimate collaboration, outrageous diversity? Do you find that present in a lot of other researchers? Is it something that's just changing over time? How does that show up in science?
So the open access movement goes, dates back to the turn of the millennium. So, but it took its time that basically scientists realized that it's important to publish open access, and of course not all do so. But the good news is, the more you talk with scientists about this topic, the more they realize that it's important. And basically the turning point is in the understanding our research is paid by tax money. Our salaries is paid by tax money. If you are an editor of a journal, often you don't get any money or just very few. If you review a manuscript, you don't get any money. But if you publish a paper, one has to pay, or either the library or the author has to pay 2,000 euro. This money goes to the publishers. And Elsevier, for example, it has been calculated 40% revenue you can get with scientific publishing.
Wow. So people get 40% potentially of their earnings through scientific publishing.
Okay. And when you make this clear, let's go to the open access journals, pay less for it. Everybody can read it wherever it's located, on the earth or in a train or at home or whatever. And 2016, we started a huge campaign at our university, Technische Universität Berlin, Technical University Berlin. And that time we had an open access share of, I think it was 16% or 20%, something like this. And now, hang on, we have 70%.
So incredible. 70%
of 70% of the TU Berlin is publishing, the scientists are publishing open access. And this is because, so I'm the open access representative of the TU Berlin. So right. I talk to everybody whether they want to know this or not, how important it is to publish open access. The general term is open science, right? And then citizen science is part of it. Open access is part of it, and so on and so on. I think it's our duty as scientists who work at universities to publish open access. So society enables us to do what we love to do, science and teaching, research and teaching.
Right.
Society is paying for this. And then we have to give it back to the society. And one way is just let them read whatever we have published for free.
That is a powerful, almost a moral obligation you're laying out there. And, when we talk about philosophy of science, and, I'm quickly out of my depth, but as a layman, I will say something about open science makes it more trustworthy. I mean, you could say this about transparency in general. I trust it more. I appreciate the scientists more. And I find, again, there's this thread throughout mycology where people do seem to be more apt to share, get the information out there. This is how we progress the science. And creating that participatory environment, I think, is healthy for everyone involved, not the least of which institutional science, right? I mean, the professionals who practice the scientific method to answer questions, if you put that information out freely, people connect with you more, they trust you more, they want to read more, you never know who's going to be able to collaborate. So I just think there's so many virtues to doing things that way. And I'm, of course, we have someone here who's an evangelist, but it sounds like you've been able to spread that to TU Berlin. And I hope to see that wave continue.
Yeah, but some of my collaborations would have never happened if I wouldn't have published open access. So I get frequently requests by artists or citizen scientists, can I join your lab or can you blah, blah, blah. And from this, and also from companies, for example. And from these first basically contacts, then several projects started to emerge. And this is because of being open. This is what I said. If you're open, you enlarge the community for the things you're interested or the issues you're interested in, because you get others interested and others also open to share.
That diversity of expertise and opinion and perspective helps. I mean, progress doesn't have to be siloed into one or another category. It's this collaborative. I mean, it's a beautiful vision you've just laid out, and you're someone who's embodying it, is really doing it. And I definitely want to talk about some of that collaboration. But, I do want to make sure we cover, just because I read a lot about it and I think it's so interesting, the work you've done with Aspergillus fungi. And you talked about it with kind of your career arc, how you were working with researchers who specialized in yeast or Aspergillus, some of these fungi that we don't see with showy fruit bodies. You know, but I'm familiar with a lot of research that's been done on Saccharomyces yeast as a model organism and what that teaches us. Tell us a little bit about why Aspergillus, the genera Aspergillus, is so useful in terms of scientific research. And if you can, characterize some of your research with the species in that genera.
Yeah. So the first thing I would love to stress is that in our community, we don't want to use the term model organism anymore, because it sounds like if you have understood this organism, then you know how the others are functioning, growing.
Of course. And when it comes to mycology and fungi, sometimes you understand one individual of a population. That doesn't even tell you about the species. So yeah, that
makes sense. And they can even look the same, but they're completely different. And so reference organism. This is at least what we try to use. But of course, often we still use the old term because we are so used to it. And Aspergillus niger, this is the main reference, or basically this is, yeah, the strain we work in our lab most of the time. This is basically the pioneer of modern biotechnology. It was 100 years ago, an American scientist, a chemist, James Curry, he identified in bioprospecting that Aspergillus niger produces a lot of citric acid. And at that time, there was a huge demand for citric acid, World War I. Citric acid was that time not produced any longer in Italy by squeezing lemons, because they were in this World War One, but there was this demand for citric acid for food industry as a stabilizer, or for pharmaceutical industry. And he went to Pfizer, that guy, and Pfizer started 1919 in New York the first production plant with Aspergillus niger to produce citric acid. So therefore, we consider Aspergillus niger as the pioneer of modern biotechnology. But he basically pioneered also other important steps in the history of these short 100 years. There's just another one can mention, which was also influential for other fields. After the Nobel Prize was awarded for X-ray irradiation, this was in the late 40s, it was realized that X-ray irradiation can be used for introducing mutations. Aspergillus niger was amongst the first organisms that were mutated to increase citric acid production. And then later on, in the late 50s, 60s, it was realized, wow, this fungus not only produced citric acid a lot, but also a lot of proteins. So it became basically the model organism, the pioneer in enzyme production. And many companies, biotech companies, which are still very strong nowadays, like Novozymes or DSM or Amano Enzyme and so on, this is because they understood in the 60s, 70s, well, niger produces a lot of enzymes. And this is glucoamylase, yeah, which is used in starch and food industry or other enzymes in the laundry industry. And then niger was also the first strain that was genetic, the first fungus that was genetically modified by plasmid transformation. And this was in the lab of Kees van den Honde, the one I went in the 2000s.
Yeah, your second supervisor.
Yeah, my second supervisor, Kees van den Honde, Leiden University. Yeah, he teaches me so much, not only in science, but really also as a person. It was a fantastic time.
He sounds like a life coach and a guru and a scientist and all of it. And from your understanding of Aspergillus niger, what is it about this organism? I mean, do we know anything about its evolutionary biology to make it produce so many different enzymes?
So the fungus, by the way, belongs also to our microbiota. So it's happy on our skin or in our oral mucosa, right? So it's already companion of us.
I see, okay.
And what the fungus specialized on, it has a very fast metabolism. So they're two main important pathways. The one is glycolysis, so that this helps to digest basically glucose, the sugar, and that introduces. And the second one is the citric acid cycle, and this citric acid cycle is basically forms the basis for citric acid, which becomes secreted, but it also forms the basis for other acids, which nowadays can be used as platform chemicals, so you can make bioplastic out of them. So succinate, for example, it makes these organic acids, which are then precursors for amino acids, these amino acids are the precursors for proteins and enzymes. So it works like hell. it works again. If you understand the genetics and the biochemistry, the metabolism, you can start to reroute or reroute. Actually, I don't know how is it correctly pronounced?
I've heard it both ways, so both are correct.
Then reroute. We reroute the metabolism. For example, we don't want to have the citric acid, or we don't want to have too many enzymes. We want to produce a drug, which is antibacterial or antifungal or whatever, anti-cancer. And we can do so now with genetic transformation, with the CRISPR technology, with all the technologies which we and of course other groups have established the last 10 years. So the last 10 years were really exceptional in technological breakthroughs. So nowadays it's very easy for us to see or to understand or to predict which genes we have to overexpress or to delete or to express at lower level to produce more of one product or less of the other, and also to modify its morphology, so the way the hypha grow and branch. Again, this brings me to this biotechnological way of thinking that I've learned throughout my study. So there's always an applied question, and this is, for example, we need a new drug or we need more of this enzyme. We have to make this more efficient, the process, so that we save energy and water and time. Yeah. So you have an applied question, but then it goes down to understanding basic genetics, basic science.
Right.
Right. And then from this understanding, again, if you understand how hypha growth, for example, occurs, and for some products you need hypha growth, for others you don't want to have too much hypha growth. If you understand hypha growth and a cell wall composition, for example, cell wall remodeling, then you get ideas, this could be a cool target to fight the fungus.
Well, and just trying to wrap my mind around this process, I'm sure it's complicated, especially just to do by words. But we're talking about these two main pathways. Obviously, there's this fast metabolism that makes this Aspergillus niger kind of like a biofactory. And then these pathways for citric acid and the glucose pathway to break down sugars.
Yeah.
Now, are we talking about, and this is kind of a multi-part question, but are we talking about each pathway has a different library of potential enzymes or basically compounds produced in each pathway, so you decide which one to modulate? And then are we only using those outputs, you know, kind of exuded from the actual filamentous fungi? Or are you using, because when you talk about, you know, hyphal structure mattering, does that affect how these compounds secrete? Or do you actually need that kind of fruit body, as it were, in some of these products?
A really cool question. So both pathways are interconnected, so they don't run. Of course, they run in parallel, but they are not organized in parallel. So the glycolysis is on top of the citric acid cycle. So the product of the glycolysis is the substrate of the citric acid cycle.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. And the citric acid cycle also occurs in every organism, in a plant, in a mammalian, in a cell, in humans. And one of the main functions of the citric acid cycle is to, and this occurs in mitochondria, is to produce ATP. And ATP is basically the energy currency of a cell. And if a cell has sufficient ATP, it can grow. If it does not produce sufficient ATP, it will not grow. And if you start not playing around, but basically start to modify the metabolism, you always have to be aware that, especially this we call this primary metabolism, because this is so essential for the organism. If you start optimizing this or changing this or modifying this, then this will always have consequences. For some products, if you basically boost too much product formation, then this goes at expense of biomass formation. And then the fungus is very sick. And sometimes this is too sick that it would make sense to use this in a bioprocess at industrial scale. But often, less biomass formation is very wanted, because the less biomass you have later on to get rid of as a waste product, the better.
Right.
And so it's a balance between fungal health and the products you want to overproduce. The good news is that nowadays we have these technologies in hand, and in total we are 30-35 Aspergillus niger labs in the world who work with this fungus on a molecular level. we have these tools from systems biology in hand and from synthetic biology in hand. Systems biology means that you, as much as Naja has 14,000 genes, humans have 30,000 genes, Saccharomyces cerevisiae has 6,000 genes, E. coli 5,000, 3,000, depends on the strain. That we look in parallel at all 14,000 genes for Aspergillus niger, whether they become transcribed and translated to a protein under a certain condition in a bioreactor, in a shake flask, on a petri dish, whether it competes with another fungus, whatever. And, right. and whilst looking in parallel of all these genes, we can generate so-called gene co-expression networks, which help us to predict you need a set of 5 genes or the set of 100 genes that you need to modify, and then you will get another morphology or another product formation. Or, of course, we are not there yet in really designing, yeah, from scratch. Probably this is a vision for the next, still a vision for the next 50 years or so. We are far away from designing from scratch an organism. This is basically the main goal, the vision of synthetic biology. But the understanding, the systems view on a cell helps us in synthetic biology to design the biofactories or cell factories we want to have.
So yes, and I guess to kind of companion with that, in some of the modifications that you do in understanding the gene co-expression, how that will affect the outputs, are you always working with a library of compounds, whether that's enzymes, you know, whatever the Aspergillus is producing? Are you working with its native library and modulating some of those internal, I want to call it the internal bioreactor of the fungus, but the internal processes, transformation processes of the fungus? Or does some of this gene co-expression even allow the fungus to create new compounds? My instinct says we can't necessarily create new compounds. So is it just modulating what of the library potential compounds, what they can produce, and maybe how they transform it? Or do you ever work, are you ever able to modify or make changes that allow it to make new compounds?
Yeah, very excellent question. So when we use these gene co-expression networks, we predicted some so-called transcription factors. These are regulatory proteins that decide which genes shall be expressed or not. The term expression stands for a gene becomes translated into a protein. Okay. And we have predicted so-called global transcription factors, meaning if we overexpress that single transcription factor, it will regulate, upregulate dozens, hundreds of others, of other genes. And these genes, we predicted, were involved in secondary metabolism. Secondary metabolism is, so primary metabolism is really, this is ATP, so this is, for example, the citric acid cycle and glycolytic pathway and a few others. Secondary metabolism is a metabolism, it's a term that refers to the fact that if you delete a specific gene involved in that pathway, the organism is still alive. It's not sick.
I see.
So it's not essential, whereas when you delete a gene involved in primary metabolism, this is lethal.
And the secondary metabolism, is it using outputs of the primary metabolism as substrate?
So in the world of fungi, the secondary metabolism, these are pigments, for example. These are aroma compounds. These are other compounds which might have antibiotic activity, so bioactive compounds. And there's a huge quest in these secondary compounds because we are all looking for penicillin 2.0, right? Because of this antibiotics crisis. So coming back to your question, so yeah, we see that when we start modulating the expression of a few transcription factors, that this results in a production of complete other compounds, new ones, not known ones, others become next expressed. And we are not there yet to understand which are the biosynthetic pathways involved. We are not there yet. What are the compounds good for? We are not there yet to identify, okay, this would be a good target for, let's say, a good, whatever, anti-cancer drug. But the tools are there. These are the good news. The tools are there, and they have been published, open access. So everybody can basically repeat these experiments or get their ideas from these data. And there are excellent open access databases, like FungiDB or Mycocosm, I guess many are known to the community already, where people can have a look which function of genes is already known or which compounds are now of interest. It's really mind-blowing what's now possible. And what we definitely have to work on is to get more and more people interested in the fungal world. So we need more manpower to understand and harness also the power of fungi.
That concept is mind-blowing, that they're able to produce novel compounds. You know, and that's what's so funny to me too, is that we're talking about the height, the frontiers of quote unquote technology is really allying with another organism and then working with that to produce novel compounds. And as kind of a final question, when we are talking about some of these novel compounds, and obviously you talked about, you know, we don't even know what some of these are. Generally, how are you collecting, and this gets down to, I guess, just the probably a detailed process, but how do you actually collect those compounds to then work with and use, just so we can visualize it? Is it like capturing in a petri dish? Is there a chemical process that kind of has those filter through? How are we capturing the compounds that these fungi produce?
So if we want to know which compounds are produced, we run bioreactors. These are 5-liter liquid cultivations, so we call this submerged cultivations. And we analyze the compounds in the medium, in the supernatant, and in the biomass. And for this, we need proper protocols for extracting. And the type of the protocol also decides what kind of compounds you can purify, whether they're hydrophilic, water-loving, or whether they're hydrophobic, water-repellent, and so on. Because we are not chemists, we give these purified biomass samples or these purified supernatant samples to our chemists here at Tubulin, and they do so-called mass spectrometry analysis. This is the way an SMS and so double two ways of mass spectrometry analysis. And then if you really want to know what kind of compounds is, then there comes this NMR analysis, nuclear magnetic resonance, there comes X-ray crystallography, and so on and so on, if you really want to have a pure compound in hand. But this is, there we collaborate with chemist departments from our lab, from our TU. And just as an example, so there was one compound we were interested in. This was a project together with also a company and this chemist people. Aspergillus niger was able to produce several grams per liter of this compound. And you might think, okay, a few grams per liter doesn't sound much, but
right.
A milligram is sold for 100 euro.
Oh, wow. Okay. That changes, that whole perspective.
Because this is a pharmaceutical compound. And this, we are not selling this, but this, I simply give this this number or this insight, because this tells you the power of these fungi, and especially of Aspergillus niger. So I'm pretty much, and of course I'm unbiased. No, I'm biased. of course I'm biased. But so far I haven't seen any other filamentous ascomycete seed that is so efficient, so versatile in terms of it can produce a lot of organic acid, a lot of enzymes, and now also a lot of these secondary metabolites. I'm not aware of any other. There are some like Trichoderma, they are specialized in enzymes. There are other, they're specialized in enzymes like Aspergillus oryzae, Koji fungus, and so on. But not within a single fungus having this flexibility. And therefore, this is for me the biofactory for compound production. Another important point I would love to make is, of course, this is a saprophyte, but if the immune system of a human being becomes compromised, then it can be an opportunistic pathogen. So again, with the same fungus, we have this also Saccharomyces cerevisiae can also become an opportunistic pathogen if the immune system is down. So meaning with the same fungus, we can follow our trajectory in terms of using fungi, but also fighting fungi. So we have a couple of antifungal compounds, which we would love to develop as drugs. And these we use, for example, to fight in the lab, to see how Niger responds, whether it develops resistance against it, and so on and so on and so on.
Well, and that relationship of fungus as friend or foe, Aspergillus niger is able to help us on both fronts. It sounds like an infinitely modular biofactory once you know enough. And again, another question that may get too lost in kind of the details, but how much biomass are we talking? We talk about, and I know in that example, you talked about a few grams per liter, but to get a substantive quantity of useful compounds, how large, you know, a vat of filamentous fungi are we talking about?
Yeah. So in the lab, the lab scale is usually 5, can also be 10 or 20 liter. This is max. So in our lab is 5 liter. But in industry, the vessels, the vats are 500,000 liters. So 500 cubic.
Massive.
And there's again a cool question because this brings to the point. So if you know, okay, this fungus produces whatever compound. If it now has to go into a 500,000 liter reactor and has to become stirred and fed with the glucose and with the oxygen and pH control and having this hydrostatic pressure, for example, if you at the bottom.
I didn't think of that. Yeah, when you get to that scale.
This is what we call a scale-up problem. If you want to scale to industrial production, the physics of cultivation changes. Yeah, the world of fungus is in the physics of the world for the fungus changes because there is a complete other dissolved oxygen tension. There is another hydrostatic pressure. And imagine a stirrer that is stirring such a huge reactor. And the glucose comes either from top or it comes from the bottom. So it takes a few minutes that it becomes completely homogeneously distributed, the glucose. In this time, the hyphae or the cells which are close to the valve, they experience something like diabetes condition. There's a huge amount of glucose. Yeah. Whereas the others, which are at the opposite part, they're starving. And this is what we call heterogeneity problem in bioreactor cultivation. So it's not so easy to translate what we have learned in the lab scale. How the fungus behaves, how it grows, how much glucose it consumes per time, how happy is it? Yeah, it behaves completely different in this large setting. And this is another topic of research, and there is very much important to understand the so-called macroscopic morphology. So you all know how mycelia look like, and they have the tendency to form either pellets in liquid cultivation, so they clump together,
right,
or they remain dispersed. And if they remain dispersed, the cultivation broth is really viscous. It's like mixing a paint. Yeah. So much energy.
That makes sense.
So you have what you call rheological phenomena. You have transport phenomena. And the whole population becomes heterogeneous. So all these different pellets or dispersed mycelia, they are same, but different. Which means on a genetic level, they behave differently.
I see. Because so actually, you're getting separate individuals. Distinct.
Different populations. And now we have a project running with population dynamics people that we do understand how much heterogeneity is in such a bioreactor. And is it good or is it bad or how can we influence it? And which genes again are affected by these continuously changing environment in a bioreactor.
And that's also fascinating.
Imagine a stirrer. If you're very close as a cell or as a mycelium to the stirrer, to the impeller itself, it's a huge wave you have to survive, right? Because whereas if you're at the wall of the, that is just very much relaxing. So the cell wall resistance is also an issue we have to study. So we're coming from finding the needle in the haystack is the challenge nowadays
The bioreactor becomes its own ecology. That's absolutely fascinating. And this is an example where that incredibly fast metabolism is kind of working against it because they're processing that sugar so quickly when they get a flood of sugar that's absolutely fascinating.
I don't know from in which discussion it first emerged this idea, but then I realized that it's just you're changing within seconds or minutes between diabetes and starving, and we have an idea what this means for us humans.
Right, imagine that lifestyle.
And this way of thinking, now we have to basically translate to, okay, what does this mean for Aspergillus or another fungus?
Right. How is that changing gene expression and that kind of back and forth lifestyle? Well, there is tons more research. I really appreciate you kind of even getting down into the granular aspects of some of how this works, because I just think it's so fascinating and it helps me understand more about biotechnology and how the practicum of how some of this works. But I also do want to make sure we touch on then some of the work in biomaterials. I know this is a very nascent program at TU Berlin, but it's one that I think captures everyone's imagination, using mushroom, using mycelium as a material. Mm-hmm. So tell us about how that research came about, or this project in its current form, and then maybe what your vision is and some of the goals you hope to achieve by researching fungus mycelium as a material.
It all started when I got a proposal granted in 2018, and this was this proposal for the so-called Mind the Fungi project, where I just basically wanted to work together with other scientists, with artists, with citizen scientists, to enter also the biomaterials field. Because in 2016, I wrote an article together with a colleague from mine, Corrado, and we were just simply interested, are there artists out there who are interested in the fungal world, and what do they do with fungi? And we thought it's just art, yeah? We wrote the article, how was the title? The Beauty and the Morbid, Fungi, a Source of Inspiration in Contemporary Art. It's open access, published in Fungal Biology and Biotechnology. And then when writing this article, 2016, it was mind-blowing. This was the first time that I came across with the work of Ross, of Ian Bayer, of Maurizio Montalti. We even interviewed Maurizio Montalti from Moku. And then I saw, wow, there's a huge revolution ongoing, and it's just below the radar of all scientists. And even only I, because I was interested in art, I was expecting pure art. And it's okay, they have ideas which will form the basis for a complete new fungal biotech. And then, I also visited Phil, and then I wrote a proposal, and I got it granted. And this is, how it all started in 2018. And again, we started like James Curry, 1919. We went out for bioprospecting. So we disappeared in the forest. We collected fungi, mushroom forming, this time mushroom. So as for my seeds, these are the molds. And this was the first time that we started to work with mushroom forming fungi. And now we have a collection of about 70 mushroom forming fungi, basidiomycetes seeds. But we have boiled them down to 10 or so. Who are of interest for us. And the most interesting is this tinder fungus, Fungus fomentarius. And this is because also in 2016-17, I started to make my own sculpture. Before I knew that we were going to research years later the tinder fungus, I started to make my own sculptures.
Right, you're a mushroom artist on your own, yeah.
Yeah, and this is because I love the fruiting bodies. They are very light, but they're water repellent. You can stand on them, even if they're on a tree trunk. It's just, then it made click to me. So it's just, why not using, I knew others work with Ganoderma or Pleurotus or Trametis, and they all have their pros and others have their cons. But no one was really working with the fungus, Pomotarius, tinder fungus. And then I thought, okay, let's focus on this one. And then let's see at the end, for me, it's important to see that either of those can make it. Right? It's just now we have to think, how can we produce in the future buildings, make buildings or furniture or textiles and so on. Probably will be that one fungus is more suited for textiles and the other more for building and the other more for whatever. Again, we are a very small community, just only 20 labs worldwide. And it was inspired by artists and designers like Phil Ross.
Yeah.
And it was then taken by material scientists to one further step, and now come the fungal biologist in. And again, we have to work interdisciplinary. And again, we have to recognize and thank the art way of thinking.
You know, for me, I've always loved that idea about biomaterials in general, but this idea that human beings for a long time have been using, especially mushrooms, especially the tinder fungus, but have been using all manner of biomaterials. So to just take that insight and then bring it into more of a biotechnology field and to start thinking, how can we refine this for a number of different applications? It also sets your imagination running by think of how many different species of fungus there are. What if all of their mycelium have different properties? Can we train them to have different properties? And someone with expertise like yourself, I mean, fungal biologists and really people who work in fungal biotech, how may we be able to modulate maybe some of the mycelial expression? And I mean, this idea of it as a biomaterial seems infinite. Now, for my kind of basic understanding, one of the goals was to create almost a library for you guys. Is that the case? Are you trying to create a library of some different mycelial materials as kind of a reference point?
This is our aim. And so the way on how I foresee the future of the material field would be that, again, that we exploit the diversity, because some mycelia are more elastic than others. Others can more withstand cell wall stress than, others grow faster, others make hyperbranching mycelium, others less branching. And for example, the more air is in it, the more insulating the refining material, and so on. So there are different factors you have to think about. And basically, my vision would be that 10, 15 years from now, we have a database where basically people log in and then search, okay, I want to produce a chair, I want to produce process, whatever, which fungus shall I use for this or that product I want to make? Then there is the DIY protocol there that you can make it yourself. And then, very much important, so I envision a kind of global map, because the substrate that the fungi, the mushrooms, the fungi grow on, these would be waste residues from the agriculture and from the forestry, for example. Of course, there are different trees in California than in Bavaria and in Italy. Basically, in this database, it's included the information, what is your local fungus, what is your local tree, whatever forest, what is your local agriculture residues, which you can use to produce that. And then depending on which substrates and which fungi you work with, the protocol will likely change in terms of, perhaps you have to add something, or you have to shorten the time, or you have to extend the time, or the playground at the moment is too large.
Yes.
There are too many variables.
Yes.
And therefore it's so important that some groups say, okay, we focus now on this fungus. Others say we focus on that fungus and so on. And very much important is the risk assessment, because at the moment, say a few dozens of fungi are work has been published, patents have been published, but not all of them are safe fungi. So some of them are pathogens, others are not described as vital or medicinal fungi. And my recommendation would be just concentrate on these fungi which have safely been used for centuries or longer by mankind, like Ganoderma is a vital fungus, or tinder fungus. This has been, is also a vital medicinal fungus. It has been used for wound treating and so on. And then at the end, probably we will then have something like 4 or 5 reference fungi, not model, but reference. And these are then the ones where the material scientists can focus on how to improve the materiality together with us fungal biologists, because we can say, okay, if you turn genetics in this or that direction, then the material property will change and so on.
That was my question, is will we eventually have that similar kind of co-expression where we know what genes, and then you could even get an individual growing this somewhere.
So the idea is that all the tools which we have already established the last 10, 20 years for Aspergillus niger, that we use them for the tinder fungus, perhaps also for others, but the main concentration is the tinder fungus.
Because then if someone has a population of tinder fungus growing near them on a different tree, a different environment, you can get the genetics of that individual and see where it falls on the spectrum to the reference tinder fungus and how suitable it will be. That's absolutely mind-blowing. And it sounds like the process then, and this is something I often take away from Phil Ross, who talked about kind of staring at the fungal infinity in front of you. And yes, you need something to limit your relationship, because otherwise it's just completely staggering. So I love that idea of, okay, we're going to have to pick certain species that are well known. We've used them as materials, start there. And I would imagine there'd be a lot of work in even establishing maybe what characteristics are relevant outside of genetics, just macroscopic measurable characteristics are relevant that you're trying to track.
And there was, when we're looking back in history, the model reference organisms that the community, so the Ascomycete community work with, they all came because the, let's say, Timberlake or so in the 50s or 60s. So there were people who founded, who were founding mycologists in the universities, and their successor basically then took the same fungus like Aspergillus niger, for example, Aspergillus niger, but also Aspergillus nigerans or others. These are the, so it all started with a few who thought, okay, let's work on this fungus. And this was just by chance, the selection also, and because they were just simply intrigued by them. And nowadays, we have it the other way around. We have too many, and we have this biodiversity. But I think we as a community, and therefore this year, we had a very first meeting with a few groups who work in the material fields now. And we hope to see each other again next year so that we have a kind of annual meeting. And then I would love to discuss this with the community. Okay, let's focus on these four or five. Of course, this is not, we should not limit ourselves, but because we're not enough people, but the pressure is there. Yep, the pressure for innovation is there. We have to be very fast at developing these new materials.
Yes, and developing the frameworks by which to assess them. And I mean, who knows what, I mean, we talk about global gene expression, how that can affect, but maybe there you'll find some thread between different species that dictates that aeration or that we can start then. I mean, imagine that future where you could start mapping even species that we haven't analyzed yet, but to say, okay, we got these markers. It's indicative that it might fall on this part of the spectrum in terms of what would be useful for as a material.
Excellent, or, yeah. Would you love
to join my lab? Well, I would be so honored. It's a beautiful, I'm not sure what I could bring to that party, but it's a beautiful, it's a beautiful vision. And I love how for you, it's part and parcel with this idea of being open access. So then an artist or, I mean, even a furniture maker somewhere can have access to these biomaterials, maybe get a strain, learn the protocol, and then start working with these so it's not something that's shut off, but it becomes this widely accessible tool. And really everything we've been talking about, especially when you bring that piece about art, because anyone can look online for Vera Meyer as an artist as well. You've got some beautiful pieces of art that I was looking at before the show.
Yeah, and for example, think about also what art, how art can benefit from it. So for example, if you have the theater scene, their stage design, It's they also produce or museum they produce a lot of waste which is cannot be recycled yet, but if they learn to produce their own stages or whatever with this fungal material, they afterwards can just recycle it on their
I mean, talk about a beautiful closed system, and really everything we've been talking about then has been kind of part, and you can flesh this out, but everything we've been talking about seems like it fits into part of a worldview that I saw beautifully expressed by you and several co-authors in that work, Mind the Fungi. So just tell us, I know that's a pretty huge concept to bring in, but just the overview and really how this fits together. Because everyone talks about, oh, we're going to save the world with mushrooms. I think probably Paul Stamets here in the US has made that kind of a very famous, we're going to save the world. We don't know how mushrooms are going to save the world.
Yeah.
And when I read some of your thoughts about the triad you described in there and how these things work together, I thought this is a little bit of that kind of blueprint or maybe more of that philosophical framework. So just tell us a little bit about that triad, because I think it fits in with everything you've been talking about.
I think the very important thing is how to ask questions. An artist or citizen scientist who is not an expert, let's say in fungiology or in another life science, they look at an object or at a cell and start to ask questions which are really outside the box. Because they ask these outside the box things and approach these objects from a completely different angle, they sort of first let you think differently about what your research object is, but also they inspire you. Oh, gosh, this is an idea I never thought about. Should I? Oh, yes, I should. Because we are in the box, right? But the same is also an artist is in his or her box, and a citizen is in his or her box. So on one thing is we are all creative people, we all have ideas, and what drives us all is basically to answer the question, how do we want to live in the future that is sustainable and this is So this really concerns us all, be it that we are scientists or artists or just mycologists, right? And the question how we want to shape the future means that we need to respect the planetary boundaries, but means also that we have to think not only on a biological level, so biotech, mushroom level, but you have to think on political level, economical level, social level. And of course,
right.
We cannot answer these. We are not experts on these levels. The only way is to bring people from these different disciplines together. And this is what is called not only interdisciplinary, but this is really transdisciplinary collaboration across really disciplines and with the people, the society. Yeah, it's starting to learn what other think. So starting to listen, starting to realize that even if you use the same words, you mean them differently.
Right.
Starting to dare to ask questions and all these things. And we also published Open Access this year together with Matthias Rillich. He's also a professor here in Berlin, but at the Free University. How it is to host artists in a lab. This article is called 10 Simple Rules, How to Artists in a Scientific Lab. And there we discuss how difficult, but also how amazing it is to have these people in the lab together. It's like a sprinkling brain shower. If you start, working, collaborating with, and art is very much trained in bridging their work to the society, so we can learn from them how to communicate things and how to interact also. Art uses the scientific technologies to ask good, excellent questions. So basically, we jointly benefit. This is a mutual benefit. That's it.
Absolutely. The science, art, society triad. I love that piece about artists as communicators too. They help us draw things from within and they take insights from the kind of the greater society without. So probably as scientists are informed by art, as you as a fungal biologist who's doing art, you're helping bring some of the insights you have out into the world through these physical manifestations. And I think a key part of that as well goes with this open access idea. As microbiologists and fungal biologists suffuse the insights about fungal ecology and biology and the roles they play and the lifestyles they have starts to really inform the greater society. To me, that seems to be the key, is kind of this transdisciplinary approach, but also the insights that seem to come out of this world of understanding the microscopic and how things interact, and really always comes to kind of moral implications about, yes, we have to take care of all these different environments because there is an infinite complexity going on that everything is built on top of. And so it brings kind of this moral imperative, or suffuses that, I think, into some of these other kind of greater society at large that I see as so beautiful. And I've talked to a lot of people who feel like it's given them that insight. But yes, the transdisciplinary is at the center.
And there's another important aspect, and this, I think no one said it better than Theodor Adorno. He was a philosopher, the German philosopher last century. He said in German, Kunst ist Magie, befreit von der Lüge, Wahrheit zu sein. And in English, art is magic, freed from the lie of being truth. And this means, I understand this, and it's a beauty, again, when working with art. And therefore, we have, for example, founded this MicroX Sci Art Collective, and we have Microspace on the exhibition. If you work in art, you can speculate about the future. You can show something which you're interested in, but it doesn't have to be the truth. As a scientist, you have to run your experiments, you repeat it, they have to be reproducible, you have standardized protocols, and so everything has to be perfect, and only if you can say, okay, gene X regulates process Y, then you just write your paper. But this takes years. Whereas with art is magical.
Yes.
You get people fascinated in it. You touch their senses or empathetically. One thing, but also with art, you can. So our first habitable sculpture, fungus sculpture, it's not a house, but it's a sculpture. And it was on a show in Frankfurt Main this summer in Germany. 3 months and people were allowed to stay there overnight and slept there. And of course, it is not the final house, but they got an idea how it is to live in a fungus. If art and science work together, you can bring different time scales you can overlap different timescales. And with this, you faster approach, I would say, your vision.
Yes, the art almost lets us time travel a little bit, bring some of these insights forward, some of these perspectives forward, even quicker than the science gradually kind of catches up to and proves out. I mean, really, really fascinating insights you've left us with. Where can people find more? And I guess this is a couple of parts to it, but where can people find more about MycoX and MycoSpace? Those are the names of some of these art installations you've done. Where can people find out more about that and then find out about your work at TU Berlin?
I think the easiest way is really to approach me via Instagram. I have an account there, v.meyer. I have a YouTube channel. My pseudonym is V. Meyer. My name is Vera Meyer, but my pseudonym is V. Meyer, my artistic pseudonym, V. Meyer. So I have a YouTube channel. There you can see little movies about MycoSpace, MycoBuild, MycoX, and so on. And but also nice movies about Aspergillus. And on Instagram, once I realized there are more Vera Meyers, then I realized, oh, there are more Vera Meyers in Berlin. So if you want to find me, type in Google Vera Meyer TU Berlin, then you will find me. And from there, you can just approach the other websites.
And of course, we'll have all the links in the podcast notes so people can really dive in, because, you know, there's so much work, a voluminous amount of work you put out there, but both visual and written, and you are someone who's blending these worlds of science and art. So no matter what your interest is, there's going to be something evocative and thought-provoking there for you to find. Another question that's come to me is this idea of morality. And, you know, when a lot of people start understanding these complex interrelationships in these natural systems of fungus and microbiology, you know, sometimes people then get reactionary away from any kind of modification. And you even talked about it with introducing mycomaterials if you're using a potentially pathogenic fungi. So for you, what's your kind of framework for having these things sit together to kind of understand the complexity of natural systems and, you know, maybe the importance of conservation and how delicate how careful we have to be, that precautionary principle, and then doing things in the lab like, you know, potentially modifying and regulating the genes of organisms? How does that come together for you?
Of course, you need a thorough risk assessment, and things we are doing in our genetic lab, you cannot do at home, right? So the DIY protocols we are publishing, they don't contain any genetic transformation, whatever. Let's phrase it like this. So we are all used, let's say, to insulin, to penicillin, to other drugs. They all have been produced by genetically modified microorganisms. So we know how to benefit from GMO, for example. But on the other hand, that there's this worries about GMO modified food. And I would love to start the discussion in due time, so in 1 or 2 years, with the society. Can you imagine to live in a house which has been produced by a genetically modified fungus? But this house provides you with much better carbon dioxide balance. It provides you the opportunity that you can just leave it without leaving any waste to the environment. It helps you to avoid any fossil resources, and so on and so on and so on. And then we have to start. There is no black and white. Again, fungi, they are not only friends or not only foes. There's always a pro and always a con. And we have to start balancing the pros and the cons in the way how we use these fungi. And is the benefit higher? Like we people get vaccinated, the benefit is higher to become protected against the risk you might get, whatever, side effect. The very much important is that the discussions are non-emotional, but that these discussions are really then to the ground, settled and to the basics. And then, these are the opportunities, these are the chances, these are the risks, these are the threats. And then we have to decide as a society which way to go.
Well, and I think that's important. I'm sure everyone listening has their own spectrum of morality with different kind of demarcations in that world of gray where there is no black and white. Everyone's got their own inflection points and demarcations. But I think you brought up an interesting concept, which is to not have an emotional reaction, which may predispose you to go one way or another, and which may contradict other aspects of your life. You know, when you talked about citric acid, and you talk about some of these things that I probably use every day that come from a fungus that has been modified or had expression, a gene expression changed.
Either you buy insulin and take insulin if you have diabetes, or if you want, you also, there's no, it's up to you. But so the personal freedom remains. But it's up to us scientists to at least think about and develop technologies which will help us to combat this climate change. And here I see in the biomaterials field, I see a strong contribution fungal biotech can bring to a circular economy, to a bioeconomy.
Well, and what's beautiful is you just in even answering that question, show a transparency to wade into some of the moral waters and look at the pros and cons. And, you know, that's something that when I ask that question, I'm always like, this is a whole other field. But I think you answered that really well and leaves it open for people to kind of get their own answers and use their own personal freedom. Well, Vera, I'll have you leave us then with a couple wrap-up questions. And some of them you may have kind of answered throughout this conversation. But the first one is, what is a mushroom or fungus? Obviously, we have to open up the potential to all different types of fungi. But a mushroom or fungus that you love and why?
To be honest, I don't like to eat mushrooms. It's really weird. But there's one I like to eat. Yeah, impossible. There's one I like to eat from time to time, parasol mushroom. And this is because of this umbrella shape. Since I was a child, I have dreamed of flying. But to fly, I always swim in the air. It's still nowadays, when you have dreams, I swim in the air. This is the way how I fly. And the parasol umbrella sort of reminds me of this, the first thing. And secondly, when I was a kid, there was this, I don't know what you know, this cartoon series. So it's from the 70s, Arthur the Angel, which I watched when I was a child. It was an Hungarian-American cartoon series. And there was an Arthur, he's an angel, and basically he has gone to heaven and wants to have a good time there. But Peter keeps sending him back to the earth to do something good, to help people. And then he was always sailing to the earth with an umbrella, and the umbrella was open. And it looked the same. So now I realize it looks the same like the parasol, but it's completely open, right? And it's
an angel umbrella.
An angel umbrella. And here on earth, he experienced different adventures, but also he got in trouble. It was very cute cartoon series, Arthur the Angel.
Arthur the Angel. Well, that is just one of the best answers that I could have hoped of for that question. So thank you very much. And I think a lot of people, there's something special about parasol mushrooms, that shape. It does something in our imagination.
You can fly with a parasol mushroom.
You can fly with a parasol mushroom. You heard it here. You can fly with a parasol mushroom. And then another question, you know, and this is a big, broad one, and this could be from really any angle, but what is this intimate relationship you've developed with fungal organisms given to you? And that could be lessons learned, perspectives, but in working with these organisms for your entire professional career and then your artistic career, and I mean, what has this given to you?
I think the most fascinating for me is this constant traveling or journeying through different scales and also times, because they're so old, they're so new. So when you look at the hypha tip, this is just growing, but the older part of the mycelium is just almost dead, and this is basically undergoing recycling also, like a cannibalistic way of. So it's different scales, visible, invisible, but also times. I think this is the what really fascinates me, that I have to look at this organism on different levels, time-wise and scale-wise.
A mind-blowing perspective, and I will say you are not a small thinker. I mean, I guess it fits. As a child, you were thinking of kind of the stars all the way down to the microscopic, and now you're thinking about the different aspects of time illustrated by this organism. I mean, really, really fascinating, evocative insights you're giving to us here. And then the very last question, something, again, that we've really touched on throughout our entire conversation. But what are, in your mind, the highest aspirations for greater human society as we continue to develop, almost you could say, a reciprocal relationship with fungal organisms? We continue to work with them and understand them more and more. What's kind of your highest aspiration for that society in the coming decades, centuries?
So at least in my perception, what dominates in the fungal world and at general in the microbial world is positive interaction. And this positive interaction means these organisms, these microorganisms, these fungi, they cooperate. And they have to cooperate because the resources are limited. And they have learned that they can share even limited resources and that the whole community benefits from this. Most of the fungi live in symbiosis. Yeah, this is whole abiotic life. And this is a way of living what we humans can learn from. So how to share resources. And what we can learn from the fungal world is that this sharing of resources also works across kingdoms. You all know the mycorrhiza. So, yeah, fungi share their amino acids and phosphorus with the plants, and from the plants they get the sugar. But they share also nutrients with bacteria. They offer their mycelia, their hyphae, as highways for multi-bacteria, yeah, for long distance movement. It's about cooperation. Cooperation, this is something what we can learn from fungi. And of course, like in the real world, there are fungi, there are hackers. Yeah, you can hack the system like a mycorrhiza. Right. You have also pathogens, but this is not the majority. The majority is cooperates.
Well, hopefully we can embody that pervasive theme throughout Kingdom Fungi or Queendom Fungi, whatever you prefer, to be more cooperative, more symbiotic, work together. And maybe it's just by working with them and studying them more that it'll rub off on us as organisms. We'll become like the things that we are studying and falling in love with. Well, Vera, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering, again, really expansive questions, very detailed questions about the work, really covering everything seemingly effortlessly with beautiful insights. And just, I really appreciate you taking the time to being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It was also fun for me. So really, thanks for having me. And I very much like the way how we discussed also your questions. And it's really fun to see that the world of fungi or the kingdom of fungi attracts so much attention.